ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Courtney Harding, a professor, author, and the founder of Friends with Holograms, an agency that helps brands, advertisers, and entertainment companies understand VR and other emerging technologies. Prior to launching Friends with Holograms, Courtney worked on partnerships for Moth and Flame VR, which has produced content for brands like AT&T, Ram Trucks, and Discovery Communications. She's also released two books, How We Listen Now, Essays and Conversations about Music and Technology, and How We'll Listen Next, The Future of Music from Streaming to Virtual Reality. Courtney, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Before you entered the VR space, you were a music editor at Billboard and spent several years consulting for music tech companies. Throughout that time, the way we consume media has changed really drastically. What would you say are the key differences between then and now?
Right. So I started at Billboard in 2007, and I started writing about music in the 90s. So I was at it for quite a long time, sort of off and on, and then did it full time for a while. You know, the way we consume media has really shifted in my mind from passive to active. And that's gone from, you know, reading stuff on paper, reading magazines, and then reading stuff on the web, and then being able to discuss things on the web. So the rise of the comment section, for good or for ill, and generally it seems like it's for ill these days, but, you know, before you had the comment section, you could write a letter to the editor, but that was kind of it. There was no discussion around news. So we've moved from the passive consumption to the sort of active consumption to now the very active consumption. And that's where VR and AR becomes really interesting to me is, you know, what is the next stage of sort of actively consuming and interacting with media?
Right. I mean, that actually flows very nicely into media habits today. And one of the things I think that's interesting is that we notice multiple screens in action. I work in the TV industry, and so we notice when people are watching television, they're also on their phone, sometimes their phone and their laptop, sometimes their phone, laptop, and a tablet. And what they're doing is they're dumping out of television when it's an ad break, going into a social platform. And there's so much obsession with devices and connectivity. And then you have VR, and you really occlude the rest of the world when you go Yes. into your VR experience. And how those two things work, you know, how does that work? And also, at the moment, the tech is such that the headset is still bulky. I mean, I've seen the Magic Leap pictures. I've not actually seen the real thing. And so, you know, people's willingness to be in the experience for long periods of time as well. So I'd like to hear what you think about the consumption habits in that sense, the sort of hyperconnectivity and then the occlusion.
Right. So that's the best thing about VR is that you are completely immersed. And I've spent a lot of time in VR, obviously, over the last couple of years. But I really came to this when somebody asked me to do a meeting in VR. And it was in one of the VR social platforms. I put on my headset. And the meeting was so horrible. It was this guy who was a publicist, but he was like a really bad publicist because he was like droning on and on and on. And I was just like, oh, how do I get out of this? And then I realized I can't take the headset off because he'll know I left. And ordinarily, I mean, I am 100% one of those people who is on my phone and my laptop and my tablet, and I've got the TV in the background, and I'm constantly switching screens. And, you know, generally even when I'm on call, and if I was just on a boring conference call, which I, you know, do sometimes find myself on, I'm just doing something else. I'm, you know, looking at Instagram or looking at Twitter or writing emails. And, you know, that's the measure of a good meeting for me is how little time I spend doing other things. And,
yeah, right.
Right? I mean,
no, I think you're absolutely right. But it also goes to sort of meeting fatigue and do we really need all these meetings?
Right. It's meeting fatigue. And it's like, are the meetings useful? I mean, that's one of the ways I kind of think about who do I do business with is if I'm stuck on calls with people and they're deathly boring. I'm like, yeah, I'd rather not have to sit here and you know, look at Instagram puppies while I do this. Like, there's better uses of my time. So, but to get back to VR, I mean, you know, that's why VR is amazing for so many different things, is because you can't be distracted. And I think that where my company is seeing a lot of growth, at least in the VR space, is in training. And there's a lot of different reasons for that. I'm happy to break those down further. But one of the things is, you know, when you are doing training, when people are reading words on a page or they're watching videos, it's very easy for them to just get distracted and do something else. Whereas in VR, not only are they completely immersed in the experience and can't really get away from it, but you can track exactly where they're looking. Mm-hmm. So you can really see who's doing the training and who isn't. And I think that's a huge benefit for a lot of companies who want to do training and make sure that their employees are actually paying attention rather than just sort of half looking at a video and half staring at the window or staring at their phone. With regards to the headset, yeah, they're big and they're bulky and they're not great right this second, although they're getting a lot better. And I'm always reminded of, you know, other trends in technology. And there's a fantastic TV show that I have no affiliation with, but I love it and I'll plug it, called Halt and Catch Fire. It's 4 seasons. It's wrapped up now. It ran on AMC and it's on Netflix. And Halt and Catch Fire is about people creating technology throughout different periods, starting in the early 80s. And the first season, one of the things they do is they create a portable computer. They create a laptop. And the lead guy, who's this kind of like salesman, showman, razzle-dazzle guy, he gets up in front of a group of executives and he's hyping the laptop. And he at one point says, it's a featherlight 15 pounds.
Ah.
Right? Which at the time in 82, 83, I forget exactly what year it is, you know, that was light. Now, of course, the laptops are, you know, a couple ounces and we think that's heavy. But I was also reminded of this last week when someone sent me an old commercial from Radio Shack from, I believe, 1989. And it was a commercial for a cellular phone. And at that point, you still had to carry a box with you, like a suitcase with a phone attached to it. It's this great 80s ad. There's, for some reason, a guy on a speedboat is on his cell phone. And the next scene is this woman who's like in a, you know, full-on shoulder pad business suit at a wedding, I guess. She's like waving away the caterer because she's too important and she's on her phone. It's hysterical.
Oh,
and
my God.
The tag of the ad is it's, you know, $799. That's $300 off the cell phone at Radio Shack. Big, bulky, clunky, expensive. Who would ever want that technology? Right? So those are, when people start saying, oh, VR, it's like, oh, who's going to wear a headset? I'm like, well, who would carry around a, you know, 15-pound laptop? Who would carry around a cell phone that was $700 and you paid by the minute and you had to, you know, take a suitcase with you, right? Technology evolves. Technology changes. I've seen the headsets get lighter, better, and faster from the time I've been working in it. And this year, there's a bunch of new headsets coming out. There's the Oculus Go, which is a standalone headset where you don't have to put your phone in. So that's huge. And that's going to be $199, which is a great intro price point. That's coming this spring. There's the Oculus Santa Cruz, which is a wireless headset where you can move around and have your movements tracked. That's coming later this year. And the Vive Focus is already coming out in China, and it's going to come out here later this year. And that, again, is a much lighter headset where you can move around without having to be tethered to a computer. So, I mean, this stuff will just, again, it's like it's Moore's Law, which applies to a lot of things. It's like, it'll get lighter, cheaper, better, faster. And then it's going to hit a point, I believe, this year or in the next couple of years when they get lighter, cheaper, faster, and better enough for people to start buying them in pretty record numbers.
What would you say then about the 3D televisions and the glasses, which were really the stumbling block? And they weren't bulky at all. Is that just because it's not so immersive that it doesn't offer enough of a different experience? What would be the reason that that didn't catch on?
So VR is a whole new form of storytelling. 3D glasses are just sort of like, here's the story, but now you can view it in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that anyone was clamoring for those. I don't know that anyone was interested in those. And I feel like a lot of it was probably not marketed correctly, not created well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you didn't have a fundamentally different experience watching something in 3D. You have a fundamentally different experience interacting with something in VR. There's a chart, which obviously I can't show you because we're on a podcast, but there's a chart called the cone of learning, and it's something I reference a lot, and it's the way people consume and then retain information. And at the top is reading words on a page, and you retain like 10% of what you read, give or take, and then it moves down to watching and then listening and all these different things. And right before you get to actually doing something, right, living it, VR is the next level up because you are so immersed in it. And it really, and study after study has proven this out, you retain what you see in VR. So right. you experience the content in a completely different way than just sort of looking at a screen, passively consuming it, but maybe it's in 3D as opposed to, I mean, I go see 3D movies sometimes in the theaters, and none of them are an appreciably different experience for me than just going to see a movie. Whereas consuming VR content is an appreciably different experience.
Right, right. And from a creative standpoint, it's very different storytelling in that you have to cue people with sound because the participant is the director, if you will, and in the experience, you know, and I think that as people get better at understanding the medium, it's sort of like when television first launched and it was like plays, you know, and that's not really, then they learn the medium. And so as the creative people learn the medium, you'll even get a better experience.
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, the sound is one way to cue people. It's not the only way. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to subtly or overtly, depending on what you're trying to do, get people to interact with the content. And some of the content is best left for people to be self-directed. So I've done some really cool experiences where I'm just kind of looking around and exploring and immersed. And then there's also a lot of great experiences in VR where I'm actually creating something, Brush, Google Blocks, things of that nature, where you're completely active, you're in the world and you're creating and interacting with the world around you. Yeah. And then there's, you know, I've worked on pieces where someone is sort of telling you what to do, but it's very first person and they're engaging with you and you feel like you're in a conversation with this person. And then I've actually worked on pieces where you do have a conversation with someone. So you can ask someone a question in VR and they will answer you. And it does feel like you are talking to someone, even though that someone is pre-recorded.
Right. Is it possible to have, I mean, you had talked about having a VR meeting. Do you see that as something that will happen in terms of being more effective ways to bridge gaps? You know, a lot of technology is leading to sort of tribal behavior and not mixing and not getting to know those who are quote unquote other. Would you see VR as an opportunity where people could interact through proxies, if you will, that although they wouldn't be actually with you, they'd be interacting with your avatar, but that would build some sort of empathy?
Well, so I would like to think that.
But you don't.
Well, no, here's the thing. Unfortunately, so there's something called VR chat, which is pretty big at this point. And unfortunately, just like in the real world, female avatars are like sexually harassed and there's a lot of stuff that goes on.
Are you serious? Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's terrible. Like it's interesting. Like a woman I know was groped in a VR chat room and she was just like, well, this happened to my avatar, but did it happen to me? And like, yeah, I mean, you know, and that's unfortunate. And again, that stuff happens, unfortunately, everywhere. That's, you know, nothing to do with VR. That's just life, unfortunately. And it's kind of gross and sad. Well,
except I don't think you would actually have somebody groping someone in a meeting.
Not in a meeting. Well, and VR chat is not a meeting. It's not a professional place. It's just like a chat room. So, you know, I was in enough chat rooms in the early days of the internet to see some pretty sleazy behavior. I was like a teenager then, so that was super fun. But yeah, I don't think, because your avatars are not matched, I mean, you can make avatars that look like you, customizable, but you can't see people's facial expressions. You can't get, like, until we get to a place where we have really photorealistic avatars, which is a long way off, you know, just doing a board meeting in VR, I don't think is going to be all that useful or interesting. What I do, however, think is interesting in terms of workplace interaction in VR is the ability to collaborate in VR. So there was a case study I heard, I believe it was a car company, I can't remember which one off the top of my head, but they had engineers all over the world. So the engineers are working on an engine and they basically, quote unquote, built a prototype of this engine in a VR space. And then one group of engineers in, you know, Asia would come in the morning, their time, work on the engine in VR. So they could, you know, so they were sort of building, designing the engine in VR. They would leave and go home for the day. The group of engineers in the United States would come in, they would see the changes and they could then build from there and leave each other notes. And so you were kind of working almost, not exactly in real time, but you were collaborating in close enough to real time where you could see exactly what other people were doing, exactly what other people were building. So you weren't, you know, sending files back and forth every day, and you weren't having these different models built all the time or shipping models back and forth around the world. And, you know, that's still kind of experimental technology, but, you know, rapid prototyping in VR is huge and really exciting. And that's, I think, one of the great use cases for it, for sure.
Right. Well, what would you say, so you've mentioned sort of what are coming down the pike. What do you think is the most significant advancement that you've seen over the past year? And what are you expecting will happen in the next year?
Oh, wow. So I think the new headsets are going to be really huge. I think VR continues to get more realistic, and that's both due to advances in game engine technology. So, you know, you can build a VR piece in a game engine and have people that look realistic or very realistic and not like cartoonish avatars. So that's exciting. You know, the technology to make VR is getting cheaper and more accessible. So that's great. The new headsets, I think, are going to be really groundbreaking. Yeah, I mean, and there's more and better stories being told. And I think people are doing a lot of different things. It's still hard right now to be a VR creative studio. The market isn't mature enough yet. But we saw at Sundance, a VR film got a 7-figure deal, which is fantastic. And, you know, I know a lot of people that are doing VR pieces that are associated with different TV shows or different entertainment franchises. And, you know, there's a lot of interest behind it. There's a lot of momentum behind it. The other thing I wanted to mention is, and I don't know if we're going to get into this later, but I also work on augmented reality. And augmented reality, I'm incredibly excited by, especially in the short term, because, you know, while you're correct, as you said earlier, not everyone, in fact, most people don't have headsets, almost everyone has a smartphone. Right. And that's all you need to interact with augmented reality. And one of the things I'm most excited about there is augmented reality on the web. So web AR, which is basically augmented reality you can view through your browser. And one of the things I'm really proud of is that my company has been one of the first to work on web augmented reality. We built a prototype for a client. It's fantastic. Our developers are geniuses. I'm so lucky to know them and work with them. And it's one of those things, the first time I saw it, I like kind of wanted to cry, which is kind of sad, but also like amazing because I saw the potential for this, right? Like you could interact with augmented reality on your phone's web browser. You don't need an app. You don't need anything. You just click on a link and you're there. And you can manipulate the world around you using that. And that's incredible for so many use cases. And so that's one thing. And that's going to be rolling out more and more throughout the course of the year, along with other augmented reality apps that are in-app. And that's something I'm incredibly excited about. And that I also see as like a great bridge to virtual reality.
What would be the most applicable use case for, let's say, an entertainment company?
I think doing something with AR or VR.
AR.
So with AR, then it's sort of a, you can do all sorts of interesting games and filters. So especially if it's a younger audience, you can insert a character from the movie into a photo or into a video, and then someone can take video of, let's say it's a cafeteria table in a high school or a college, put the characters in there, have the characters interact with other people or other objects, and then share that socially with their friends. And that's something that we've seen people get into with Snapchat. And I think Snapchat is really just the beginning of this. So I think it's a lot of creating interesting, fun, user-generated content, puzzles, games, stuff that is, you know, we've pitched things that are like scavenger hunts where you have to do this augmented reality scavenger hunt, education. So if you are promoting a movie that's about a real life event, you could do a personalized, you do a walking tour, for instance, of where that event took place and allow people to use their phones to learn and find information. A really great augmented reality piece that I've seen recently was this guy, Gabo Arora, who's an incredible VR director. He did Clouds Over Sidra. He's done a lot of really incredible social good VR experiences. He built an AR piece with his students at Johns Hopkins. It was a walking tour of Baltimore highlighting famous women in the civil rights movement. And that's just incredible. It's an incredible way to present information in a much more visual, interesting, dynamic way than just sort of, you know, like a walking tour doesn't really scale because you can't hire that many people to give these tours and there's a cost there. But, you know, giving someone a piece of paper and saying, okay, on this corner, you know, this woman gave a speech, fine, great. But if you can actually see a video of this woman and actually visualize that, like that's really interesting.
Right. How does your company Friends with Holograms, so they're that's the company that's doing these AR experiences? That's the part of your business that's doing that?
Yeah. So Friends with Holograms is a full service VR and AR agency. So we offer a full range of services. We start with opportunity assessment. So usually that's us going into a brand or an agency or an entertainment company and looking at what they're working on and pinpointing what are the use cases for AR and VR and going through those and really doing that research, teasing that out. From there, we do the creative and the strategy work. So once there's an interest in doing an actual project, my co-founder and I will do all the creative, the strategy, the research, put everything together. And then from there, once that project is then sold, ready to go, funded, we will put together a custom team. So we put together custom teams for every single project. We work with really best-in-class talent in terms of developers, directors, producers, everyone you'd need, and we can work with specialists. So everyone we work with is great, but they're all great at different things.
Right.
So you get the best talent on the project for your project. From there, you know, we come back in afterwards, we help with distribution. So whether that's, you know, do we build an app around this? Where do we put this VR piece? If it's a piece for an event or a training, how do we, you know, we train then your team to use VR headsets. I mean, that's pretty easy, but it does require a little bit of learning. We can help you source the headset, source the technology. And yeah, so we do pretty much everything, but we focus on VR and AR and some artificial intelligence, but that's usually within the context of creating those experiences.
Right. How, when you're dealing with the clients at this point, how much education are you doing to even go into that initial assessment meeting? I mean,
So much. It depends. I mean, some clients are actually really well educated on this stuff. We've had great luck with some of our clients having done a lot of work and being really up on this. So that's fantastic. That makes it a lot easier for us to kind of just jump right in and get to the nitty gritty. But I would say a lot of people are starting to understand VR. I don't know that they're starting to fully understand it. I think a lot of people have maybe seen one or two pieces and they think they get it. They actually may or may not get it.
Mm-hmm.
Augmented reality is, because it's so new, people really don't fully grasp it. They think about Pokemon Go, which, you know, great. They think about Snapchat. Maybe they've seen a few other things. IKEA has an app where you can like put a couch in your living room. You know, people are starting to see stuff like that. I don't think that they fully understand what all the possibilities are. And, you know, I've talked to plenty of people that are senior digital folks at different places who don't know that web AR exists. Mm-hmm. And it is, you know, very, very new for sure. But it's something that, I mean, if I would give one piece of advice to every senior digital person at a brand or agency, I would say learn about web AR, because a year from now, you're going to be using it all the time.
Oh, interesting. You see the takeoff happening that quickly, that within this year.
Yeah, I think within this year and into next year, it depends a little bit on some other sort of technical developments on the back end, but I would be shocked if I talked to you a year, maybe 18 months from now at the latest, and web AR was not huge.
So how do you deal with the fact that budget planning has already happened and the executives didn't know web AR existed, and so they haven't had a set aside for it? I mean, when you're speaking to people and they've got a limited pot of money, what is the thing that they should be shifting it from and thus making this the right move?
I mean, that's so individualized, right? Like, I can't say, oh, just take it away from your video budget or take it away from this type of budget.
Mm-hmm. So it's an additive thing that works in concert with these other pieces, not something that replaces.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one other thing I will say, you know, a lot of brands were doing this thing where I'm doing air quotes, even though you can't see them.
I'll imagine them.
Imagine the air quotes. So a lot of brands would do this thing where they're like, we're experimenting with VR. And 201, they would come up with something that was just this like big, outlandish, crazy, weird, whatever, set aside thing. It wouldn't have anything to do with their current campaigns. It wouldn't have anything to do with their current strategy. They would spend a bunch of time and money on it. They wouldn't know how to distribute it. They wouldn't know how to get it out to people. It would have very limited results. And then they would say, oh, well, VR didn't work. And that's bad. I mean, I know that sounds simplistic, but that's the easiest way to say it. And like VR should be, VR and AR, and especially AR at this point, should be in the conversation from day one. Like, you're a brand, you're working on your new campaign, you sit down with your digital and your print and your TV and your social, and you have ideally myself or my co-founder or both of us or someone else who specializes in VR and AR. And those are the people who can tell you what the immersive strategy should be for any campaign. And it's part of a campaign. It's not just some funky little thing you do on the side. This has to be part of your overall strategy and messaging. And when you're creating assets and you're thinking about the narrative and you're thinking about how you're going to tell the story, that has to be part of it. So our eventual goal is to be in the room from the word go when people are creating these campaigns. Certainly we can come in later down the road and that's fine. And we're happy to work with people where they are. But yeah, I mean, right now, you know, I think again, it's like, look at your ROI and what's getting you results and what isn't. And maybe if there's a pocket of money somewhere that you're not seeing a ton of results, it's worth shifting away and at least trying a few things. I mean,
what would you say is the number one misconception when people start to talk to you about VR and AR?
VR, that it's too expensive. It's not cheap. It's very hard to do VR cheaply. It is more or less easy to do VR reasonably. Mm-hmm. You certainly don't have to spend $1 million on a VR piece. You don't have to spend $500,000 on a VR piece.
What would you say? That's actually an interesting, if you're, what is the price of admission to have a reasonable VR activation? You should expect at the very least to spend what?
I would say 50 is the floor.
Okay.
For something good.
And that would include not only the production, but also the strategy of how to distribute it, or it would just be the production?
50 soup to nuts is the lowest you could go. Mm-hmm. It depends. Again, it depends very much on the piece. It depends very much on the creative and how much work is going to go into it and the amount of editing and if it's built in a game engine versus shot live. I mean, there's a lot of different factors, right. But you know, that's sort of your base. From there, you can grow and do a lot of interesting other things, and you can start, you know, running up the numbers. But, you know, yeah, it's not nothing.
Right. Well, I think that that's very useful, because as technology has made filmmaking less and less expensive, yet there are some sort of fixed costs because of crew and various other things.
Right.
One of the things that's interesting is those conversations with companies where you are talking about a bid and they're like, well, how much does it cost? And it's like, well, how much does a pair of shoes cost? It can cost a lot, it can cost not so much. But there is a certain, it's not going to be 50 cents, because you've got to spend a certain amount just to get any kind of shoes. And so that's the, you know, that's an interesting point. Like, you cannot do anything for less than 50. And 50 is really your being very creative in order to make the budget get you something that you want. Limits can, you know, can make for wonderful creativity, but sort of that's the floor. So that's good. That's good to know.
Yeah, that's the floor. I don't think that number is outlandish by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, I've seen a lot of budgets and seen what people spend money on, and it's not out of the realm of possibility for things. With AR, that can be quite a bit less expensive, because obviously you're building a lot of AR stuff in a game engine, and you know, all the costs there besides the creative and the strategy are just on the development side. So, you know, if you want to do something a little bit less expensive, AR is certainly a good option if you want to just start experimenting in that space. Yeah, I mean, VR, you know, and the other thing with VR too is like, you have to look at where the money is going. And I've seen some very expensive VR projects and people are like, oh, that costs, you know, that much money. And then on the back, you know, and I talked to people that worked on them, and it was like, well, yeah, but they had four senior creatives from a giant agency who were working on them and changing everything. And those people cost a lot. So, you know, you have to always sort of break out some of these costs. And it's a shame when you get these big budget VR pieces that kind of don't do very well. And you get a lot of people siphoning off the budgets, because that, I think, scares a lot of people off. But
right. Are you working directly with brands typically, or are you brought in by agencies? Who contacts you?
Both. So we do have some direct relationships with some brands, and we also work with some agencies, and then we partner with them to then work with their brands.
Right. Right. I see. So a certain number of our listeners run their own businesses, and for a business that's interested in being aware of, you know, as vendors who serve entertainment companies, should everybody be creating a capacity to deal with web AR, or is this something that, as long as you're aware of it, that's all you need? How critical is it for smaller vendors?
For smaller vendors, I don't think you need like in-house capabilities necessarily. Definitely you need to be aware of it, and definitely you need to be thinking about it. But, you know, that's where someone like we can come in and you know, help you out and help you learn about it and help, you know, find those developer resources and get the stuff built. You know, I think eventually in a couple of years, every agency will have some sort of in-house VR and AR, at least person, if not a full team. So that's kind of what we're banking on in the long run. But again, it's one of those things where my fear is always this when this stuff is starting out. And I actually did this, and I'll sort of come clean. So when Twitter first started really happening, and I guess it was 08, 09 maybe, I was at Billboard, and I remember saying about Twitter, like, this is so dumb. Why would anyone use this? Like, what's the point of Twitter? And having like my intern at the time just do Twitter, because I was like, oh, you're a kid. Like, you know this internet. Like, you go to do the Twitter, right?
Right.
So, you know, fast forward 10 years or so, and obviously Twitter is what it is, and there's entire, you know, agencies and industries built around Twitter and other forms of social media. So that's, I think, where we're at with VR and AR, is we're at that very early stage where I meet a lot of people who are like, this is silly. I mean, I was on a panel with someone who is a senior person at an agency, and she was like, I'm a VR skeptic. And I was just like, okay, like, you're going to be wrong, but cool.
good on you.
I don't know why you're at a VR panel. Like, I guess you didn't have anything better to do, but okay. Like, sure.
Well, she's there to be your foil.
Yeah, I mean, sure. And like, that's fine. And, you know, there's definitely a lot of good debates to be had about the strategy behind VR, what type of creative works best in VR, things like that. And that's super, super valuable. But, you know, we're at the stage right now where it's new enough where I think it's easy for people to write it off. And, you know, another good example is I was talking to a guy recently who's now a pretty senior guy at a different agency, and he started at agency.com back in the late 90s. And he said he spent 2 years at agency.com convincing businesses and brands that they needed websites. And almost all of them said, you know, that's so dumb. The internet's a fad. Why would anyone need a website?
Right.
Da, 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 da. And then he said, and you know, he's exaggerating for dramatic effects, but he basically woke up one day and his phone rang off the hook and everyone was like, we need a website. We need a website. And then, you know, the resources are really limited. You're already playing catch up. You're already behind. So the best way, if you're a business or an agency, to look at VR right now is the time to start learning, experimenting, iterating. You don't have to put in a ton of money. You don't have to do anything huge and splashy, but you should at least start playing with it, and even more urgently, start playing with AR, so that when this does happen, you're not left behind the eight ball and you're not scrambling to play catch up. And, you know, every senior executive on your team is like, wait, this is the headset thing? What's the headset thing? Oh no.
Right.
You don't want that.
Right. So when you're programming, I mean, that's an entirely different resource than a lot of creative production companies have had on, you know, they might have people who design websites, and they might have people who do sort of some light tech, but the level of coding, I mean, how complex is it? And do you use coders who are located here in America? Do you work with people remotely? What, and how do you source the talent? And what if you're somebody who isn't of that world? How do you assess whether you're getting the runaround or the truth from people?
To answer your last question, you can call us.
And,
you know, and I say that sort of flippantly, but also, yeah, I mean, it's the way you sort of assess anyone else. You look at their portfolio, you look at their body of work, you try their experiences. Mm-hmm. In terms of our talent, so both my co-founder and I have worked in VR for a while now. My co-founder has worked in it for even longer than I have. And we are, you know, we've spent a lot of time getting to know people, building relationships, going to meetups where it's very technical. My co-founder is the CTO of the company, so I do more of the business development. He does more of the technology, and we both do creative and strategy. And, you know, he's an incredible asset and an incredible human, and he knows very quickly how to sort of identify who's good and who's not.
Mm-hmm.
you know, we generally work with teams based in the US. We have talked to some folks that are based in different parts of the world. We're open to working with folks in different parts of the world, as long as the work is good quality. We don't care where you live. So we're certainly, you know, pretty global in that respect, but we definitely aren't outsourcing to like cheap dev shops in the middle of nowhere. We will only work with sort of the best quality people. And that I think is one of the strengths that we provide, is not only do we know a lot about VR and AR, is we know about exactly who you need to build it. And that goes also for the, not only technical talent, but the creative talent that we bring in. So directing VR, directing in 360 is not easy. And there's a lot of very talented 2D directors out there who haven't made the switch yet and don't know how to make the switch. And I've seen a lot of work done by people that are incredibly, incredibly talented in 2D who just can't wrap their heads around working in 360. And so one of the things that we also have is this roster of incredible, incredible directors who we can work with on different projects who know how to direct in 360. And that's huge.
Right.
You know, if you're an agency or a bigger company that has in-house director talent, now is the time probably for them to start learning that stuff.
Right.
360 cameras now are pretty cheap. I have a Samsung 360 camera that I take with me and play with, and, you know, nothing I ever shoot on that will see the light of day, but it's a good way for me to learn to think spatially.
Right.
And that's, I mean, those are cheap. So buy some of those for your directors and just have them start using it. Cause like, that's the only way you're going to learn how to do this is by doing it.
So that just, we're running through our time, but I do want to touch on one thing. So you buy 360 cameras and you play around with them. You're doing the business development for your company. You've released two books. You're an NYU professor. You co-founded a crowdfunding startup. You're a regular writer and editor. You're a 36-time marathoner and ultra marathoner. How do you do this? I mean, just purely, do you sleep? Do you have productivity hacks? How do you accomplish so much?
Oh my gosh. Thank you. Wow. Thank you. I don't know. I mean,
you've got to share with the class. Come on.
So it's a couple of things. So one, I am just kind of a workaholic and I always have been. So I work a lot. I really, really, really like what I do. And I was at a holiday. I was in town between Christmas and New Year's, and my co-founder was as well. And so I was at Christmas dinner and I was just kind of like, gosh, I can't wait to like go hang out with my co-founder and play with a whiteboard for 2 days. And we spent 2 days locked in a room with a whiteboard doing all of our planning for the year and all of our analysis of the previous year. And, you know, just occasionally breaking and like goofing off and talking about other stuff. And it was so fun. And I walked out of those 2 days feeling so excited. So a lot of it to me is it doesn't really feel like work because I'm like so thrilled to be doing what I'm doing. That said, I guard my time really, really zealously outside of work stuff. So I've outsourced a lot of stuff. I'm like a big old Seamless addict. I have a really lovely woman that I pay every other week to clean my house. And it's, you know, and it's a luxury, but it is what it is. And like, that helps me. So I certainly can credit her because she's amazing. And I can credit the wonderful Seamless folks and restaurants that I order from constantly. And yeah, I mean, in the last year or two when I've been super busy, you know, I have a lot of things fall by the wayside in terms of maybe people I was hanging out with that I wasn't super excited about hanging out with all the time. You know, now I focus on the people that are actually my real and true friends that I care about and spending time with them and just trying to, you know, balance everything. And it's not that easy sometimes. And I definitely do feel like overwhelmed sometimes or frustrated sometimes, but you know, the other part of it is it's really fun and exciting. And I get a lot of energy and thrill out of doing what I do. And you know, I started teaching for the semester last night and it was great. Like I love standing up in front of that room full of really incredibly smart kids. And it's such an honor and a blessing for me to get to do that. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of coffee involved, I guess. Like,
do you end up getting sucked into social media? People, you know, do you avoid social media? Cause that's another thing people talk about.
I probably should do less on social media. I've tried to cut back. I guess one of the productivity hacks I have is So I try to be really agile, both in my life and my company. And so one of the things I do is I keep a list, not a detailed list, but kind of a running list of like, here's everything that I like did today and accomplished today. And I keep it going throughout the day. And again, it's not super detailed. It's like, talk to so-and-so, it led to this. Talk to so-and-so, did such and such, you know, and it just kind of keeps the list every day. And I, you know, I run it every 2 weeks. And so at the end of the 2 week period, I'm trying to get my co-founder to do it as well. And we sit down, or I sit down with myself and I say, okay, what did I do that was useful? And what did I do that wasn't useful? Like, what did I do that led to results? And what did I do that was kind of a waste of time? Everything business related that I do that I don't feel led to results, I just stop doing it. So, you know, is there a group that I joined, but maybe it's just kind of not working for me? Then I'll drop that group. And I'm kind of constantly just reassessing and reevaluating and moving the pieces around and just trying to figure out like what's working and what isn't. It's like a very imperfect science.
Well, it's like what's interesting is it's a reverse to-do list. I mean, you know, instead of scratching things off just as you tick them off, but that's sort of all retroactive. It's the proactive, and also you have a sense of positive. And so you're training to think about, well, what did you accomplish? And you've
done
those things which were accomplished. And I think that that's really an interesting way to look at things. Well, we have absolutely run through our time. I really appreciate that you spent this time with me. It's been great.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, Courtney Harding. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.